the ankle and the hip are contribute the most to the propulsive phase of a horizontal hop. And when you look at the muscle forces that they measure, the soleus is by far the biggest force contributor. So I think if you're doing a single leg hop for distance test, you're getting a good measure of explosive qualities from the soleus muscle, and particularly especially when you're going from a bent knee position, because you have an accelerated center mass, which is a which the soleus is the has a big role in that.
Welcome to the Pace Your Performance podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high-performance sport. If you're a practitioner or clinician looking to increase your knowledge around calf, foot strength, and calf and foot rehab, this is definitely an episode for you. So we reference Colin's article on Sportsmith from a few months ago, which got lots of traction because it was very in-depth in terms of the assessments and the interventions that Colin uses for the calf and foot. So we dive into that, we have a look at the assessments, we go that into detail with that, then we look at how we use the data from those assessments to create interventions through a rehabilitation process or with a performance goal at the end of it. One thing that I found really interesting is the talk around the foot. So what assessments can we do to understand more about the foot, more about the big toe, and some interventions off the back of it based on Colin's experience as well. So a really interesting episode for all those practitioners, all those clinicians looking to build their knowledge in this area, and I hope you get as much out of it as I did. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Play. Play is the leader in high-performance athletic flooring and strength equipment globally. So with offices in the US, Australia and the UK, Play provides an end-to-end experience by collaborating with organisations through their own proprietary formula to create world-class environments for coaches and athletes. Play's Achieve 18mm rubber and Attack Turf have been at the cornerstone of elite training facilities for now over a decade, with the addition of the new Icon X rack range. Play are once again set to elevate the industry. On the 23rd of April 2022, Play will be hosting their first UK lab of the year in collaboration with Loughborough University. Play will be joined by some exceptional speakers from elite sport, industry and academia with a huge breadth of knowledge and experience. Listeners and supporters of Pace Performance Podcast are able to obtain an exclusive 20% discount using the code SPORTSMITH20 when registering at playacademy.com/play-labs-Loughborough. And this episode is also sponsored by Hawken Dynamics. Hawken Dynamics is the world's first wireless force plate testing system. The Hawken Dynamics system is built for coaches to test in the real world, not just in the lab. Capture reliable data on all your athletes in a matter of minutes and monitor their progress in the cloud from anywhere in the world. The Hawken Dynamics force plates are wireless, portable, and trusted by teams at every level of sport. Integrating force plates into your athlete monitoring program has never been easier or more affordable. If you want to see the Hawken Dynamics force plate system in action, head over to their website, hawkendynamics.com, to schedule a demo or follow them on Twitter at Hawken Dynamics. And this episode of the podcast is also sponsored by iMeasureU. iMeasureU is used by leading sports practitioners and biomechanics researchers worldwide to capture and compare multi-limb inertial data in the field. IMU Step from iMeasureU is a dual sensor and app lower limb load monitoring tool which helps practitioners optimize return to play for running based sports. iMeasureU have just released their new and improved waterproof sensor Blue Trident, which includes ultra high G capabilities to quantify high impact steps such as cutting, landing, and sprinting, longer life battery to collect data all day, real-time feedback to aid immediate interventions, and faster workflow so practitioners can review long training sessions within minutes of training completion. iMeasureU, now part of Vicon, works with military, pro, and collegiate coaches and athletes from around the world, including the Australian Institute of Sport, the US Department of Defense, and collegiate and pro teams from around the world. If you want to get to know more about iMeasureU, head over to their website, imeasureyou.com, or follow them on Twitter or Instagram at imeasureyou. So without further ado, over to the episode with Colin. Colin Griffin, welcome to the Pace of Performance podcast. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be on. Look, I've been a big follower of your podcast for a good number of years now, so delighted to be on it and hopefully have a good conversation.
Absolutely. Just reminiscing that it was nearly 9 years since starting the podcast. So, no, wow. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate that. So it's great to get you on. We're going to use, like I've done with a couple of people recently, actually, use the article that you published on Sportsmith as a bit of a foundation for the chat, and we'll delve a little bit deeper into some of the exercises, some of the principles, some of the thoughts, theory behind that article in the podcast. So really looking forward to having a little chat. Calf strength, foot strength, all the kind of Achilles rehab, all the kind of good stuff. So just before you dive into that, would you mind just giving us a bit of a bio on you?
Yeah, sure. I suppose I'll begin with the present. I work in the sports surgery clinic in Dublin. I'm a strength and conditioning coach by trade, and I'm a clinical lead for foot and ankle rehabilitation stream in our sports medicine department. So our department kind of works in sort of rehab streams for different areas. Look, I've been working there for the last nearly 9 years, 8.5 years. I don't know where the time has gone. So it's been quite a steep learning curve. Worked with some great people, I suppose, past and present. And it's been a great environment, and I suppose made a lot of good connections outside of my work as well. Stemming back a little bit, I grew up in a sporting household. Both my parents were involved in athletics. My mum was an international runner. My dad was more into the coaching and admin side of things. So that was the environment I grew up in. So from my earliest childhood memories, we're going to watch my mother compete in races. She was quite close to qualified for Olympic Games. You know, so she operated on quite a high level. Did a lot of innovative things in her time, you know, like plyometric training, altitude training, and all that. So that was, I suppose, a very early exposure to that. My dad then, he was director of coaching for Athletics Ireland, as it was known now, back in the 60s and early 70s. And he was team coach for the Olympic Games in 72 and 1980, and then went on to become president of our federation in the early 90s. So there was plenty of like coaching manuals lying around the house, plenty of magazines, plenty of videos. So I was kind of getting immersed in that at a young age. So as well as being an athlete, which was hard to avoid in that environment, I was also a student of the sport. And yeah, look, with the support of my parents and wider family, enjoyed a quite fulfilling athletics career. Competed internationally, junior level up to senior level, and two Olympic Games. And I would say, like, I wasn't the most technically gifted athlete. I had to work hard to try and acquire technical mastery, even though I competed in a technical event. So that, I suppose, gave me the curiosity for human movement, whether it was trying to sort injuries, whether it was trying to improve technique or biomechanics. And I suppose getting a passion for, I suppose, the work I'm doing now, and definitely fortunate to work with a lot of good practitioners, physios, S&C coaches, sports scientists in my own time as an athlete, who were quite helpful to me. And also, I suppose, to connect to people too, as I suppose transitioned into my professional career. So like, I retired from elite sport in 2013, probably having, I'd say, underachieved, but at the same time, I had my chances and opportunities, and I probably gave as much as I could to the sport and to my career. And I suppose at that stage, I had, I suppose, other career and family decisions to weigh up.
Wow. I knew you'd competed, but why did I not know that you'd competed at Olympic Games?
I don't know. it's a long time ago now.
Tell more people about it, Colin.
it's out there. Like it's a very old chapter in my at this stage. But great experiences. And look, I'm very fortunate for the opportunities I had in the sports. Like I did, my event was a 50K walk. So as I said, a technical event. It's judged strictly enough and a bit like refereeing, quite subjective. And, you know, I was disqualified actually in both Olympic Games. London was particularly difficult because I was actually in really good shape. I was competing for a top 16 position and on course for big PB and got my third red card just before the 40K mark. So, look, all those things, I suppose, you know, gave me the curiosity and the hunger to try and understand movement better, understand biomechanics, and try to problem solve better. And I suppose what I couldn't do for myself, I hopefully can help, I suppose, try and do for others that I'm fortunate to work with.
Interesting. So where did your interest in lower limb come from? Because that's the way you've gone for your PhD, and that's what we'll chat around today. Why that area particularly?
Yeah, so when I started working in the clinic, I was kind of dealing a lot with running injuries, and a lot of our running injuries are lower limb. So I think from the hip and particularly the knee down to the ankle and foot. And so we saw a lot of calf injuries, and not all of them are calf strains. Some of them are kind of like exertional pain injuries, like basically an overload to a muscle that has probably poor capacity. Saw a lot of Achilles tendinopathies quite early on, and sort of taking a few on, and sort of took an interest in the area, got some good outcomes. Definitely, I suppose, realized I needed to learn a lot more about it. And over those, I suppose, subsequent few years, developed a bit of an interest, a research interest in it, and developed a few research questions. And I suppose to the point where I undertook a PhD in the area, and hopefully now coming to the end of it in the next 2 months.
I spoke to Phil Glasgow. You've come across Phil, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Phil well.
Good. I thought you must do. And he was talking about in the podcast I did with him a couple of weeks ago that this transition in certainly in his environment from lots and lots of hamstring injuries 2, 3, 4 years ago, obviously lots of research in the area, but that seems to been them injuries now seem to manifest in the calf and Achilles issue, into calf and Achilles issues. Is that something that you're seeing? And if so, do you think is there a particular reason for that?
Yeah, I think I suppose Phil is referring to the incidence of higher incidence of calf injuries that seem to have now caught up or surpassed the incidence of hamstring injuries in rugby, particularly in the Irish rugby setup, among the national sides and provincial sides. I think actually I was listening to that podcast, and Phil made a very relevant point about perhaps the lack of exposure to, I suppose, a certain volume of running might be just predisposing the calf to, I suppose, having poor capacity and maybe a higher risk of those type of injuries. Because as we know, the calf and the soleus, they operate at quite a high capacity of high proportion of their muscle capacity or force capacity at even, you know, slow to moderate speeds. And I suppose the shift in the last 10 years towards high intensity interval training as a means to almost cheat the aerobic system into getting fit quite quickly, and that it just might be under exposing the calf, the musculoskeletal demands of those sports, even field sports where there's a lot of time on your feet, even though maybe a low percentage of it might be high speed running or moderate speed running, but you know, the time on your feet does add up, and those lower limb muscles, particularly the calf, are they're always on. So I think that might be part of it. And I suppose traditionally S&C programs haven't really focused deliberately on the calf muscles, in terms of strengthening them and developing capacity, and maybe relied on a lot, maybe more on plyos and other exercises to develop that, and which you do, but for some athletes or players that mightn't be enough, and they may need that little bit of deliberate exposure for, 6 to 12 week blocks in the preseason or certain times of the year.
So just stay on this area, stay on the calf, and again, referencing the article, assessments. What assessments can we do to identify whether this is an area that needs additional focus?
Yeah, and I suppose in the last, couple of years, with I suppose the more easy access to fourth play technology, and I suppose becoming more affordable to a lot of clinics and clubs and organisations and universities, it's probably easier now to start standardising calf tests, particularly seated calf isometric test. So that's one that we use. And obviously when we bend the knee close to 90 degrees, we're isolating the soleus a little bit more. Because as we know, the gastroc muscles cross the knee joint. So when you bend the knee, we're making those muscles shorter and they're and a little bit more redundant. So that's one way of assessing calf strength, particularly for the soleus, which again is quite important for field sports. And even, in sprinting where during the acceleration part of it, where the soleus is a big player. And also for distance running as well, because the soleus is a big supporter of the center of mass. And as I said, operates at quite a high capacity. So that's probably one test that can be standardized across many areas. And again, there's a little bit of inconsistency, I suppose, in terms of knee angle and levels of ankle dorsiflexion you might set up with. And so I suppose a few areas there that probably just need to be fleshed out a bit more. And then I suppose to get a measure of total plantar flexor peak torque or peak force, we use an isokinetic test, lying in a prone position, so face down, legs straight, at a speed of 30 degrees a second, working from 30 degrees plantar flexion to 20 degrees dorsiflexion. And measuring peak torque, and we kind of scale that to body weight. And say for distance runners, we'd like to be, you know, 150-160% body weight and above. And for our sprint athletes, being getting close to 200% body weight. We don't get many hitting that, but that's, I suppose, from the numbers we've collected over the years, that's sort of the targets we try and set based on uninjured athletes we work with, and also fully rehabilitated athletes that we've managed to progress up to that. But obviously, not everyone has an isokinetic dynamometer, so you can do the even a straight leg, standing straight leg isometric test with the force plates, you know, which is part of some of Alex Natera's work. The challenge there, I think Alex actually found a solution for that by actually using a block, where you can, because when you stand on the force plates, it's still a compound movement, so it's hard not to involve the knee extensors and hip extensors, and you don't know how much of that is coming from the plantar flexors. So when you use a block and get your alignment right and get more leverage through the ankle, you can probably get a better reflection of the calf contribution to peak vertical force. And again, as a surrogate measure of total plantar flexor or calf force. So those are the two sort of strength tests that we would look at. And then we'd also look at developing or look at assessing capacity, whether it's doing even on the isokinetic dynamometer set. And Neil had a good test that he validated during his PhD, where you just do 20 reps and measure total work done as a measure of calf capacity, or in a very, very basic clinical setting, do like a heel raise endurance test, where you work off a metronome of 1 second up, 1 second down, trying to have consistency of height, consistency of tempo, good control of the rear foot. And when either of those diminish, you stop them. And if they can get to 30 reps before that happens, that's a good measure of calf capacity. Maybe minimum 25. And if they're below that, then there's probably that they probably need to work on their capacity. And you use that then to set your programming.
Would you mind just describing that seated isometric test for us again, Colin?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I have a picture of it in the article. But
there is.
Yeah, but no, to talk through it, like, yeah. So we sit them with the knee around. So the knee sort of over the shoelaces. In about, I kind of go for 10 to 15 degrees dorsiflexion. I think you need some bit of dorsiflexion to get a proper measure of peak force in the soleus. It does, you know, you need a little bit of length in the muscle tendon unit to get that. And then have the knee around, you know, 90 degrees knee flexion. And then have the base of the first metatarsal on the block. And then we use ratchet strapping to strap the knee down. So there's very little slack in the system. So we just make sure that we give them a few familiarization trials, and if there's any loosening of or any loss of tension in the ratchet, we just tighten it again, so that when they do their test trials, it's good and tight, and they're able to maintain their dorsiflexed ankle position. And we would go for three reps of a 5 second maximal isometric effort, and take the best out of the three.
And it's the 4 foot on the block with the block on
4 foot, the, yeah, foot. From the base of the first metatarsal upwards, yeah.
And then the obviously block on the force plate.
Yes. So, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So we weigh the weigh the force plate with the block on them and calibrate from that.
Yeah, it's interesting because Phil mentioned them using this as a test, as a monitoring tool, not only for capacity but monitoring fatigue in this particular area because of the rise in calf and Achilles issues in Irish rugby, well, rugby as a whole, but Irish rugby in his environment. So yeah, kind of feeds into that discussion as well.
Yeah, and it's when you get into a flow, like, it's actually quite a quick and easy test to administer. You know, you can be done in 10 minutes and it's not that invasive. Like, you know, yes, you're working hard for those few seconds at a time, but the soleus is a predominantly type 1 fiber muscle, so it's going to recover quite quickly, and you can go on about your business for the rest of the day. So, and I suppose if you are in an environment like in a professional sport, where you can do that on a weekly basis or whatever, you know, it can be a quick test to do in the Monday morning. And, you know, if someone's a little bit off where they normally are, where their baseline levels are, it might be then a flag then to monitor their or to adjust their training loads for that given day or week.
So we've taken our athlete through this testing battery. We've identified that things are lower than we want them to be. Next stage is obviously strengthening that particular area. I'm guessing that the vast majority of practitioners out there, if they're doing this kind of training, it'll be calf raises, either seated or standing. What other opportunities have we got to strengthen this particular area?
Ideally, a Smith machine or a leg press, you know, where you can really go heavy on the calf and isolate it. and be quite stable, which is kind of hard to get that with a free bar, and it's quite hard to hold a heavy dumbbell if you want to go really, really heavy. So I suppose if you have access to those, there's a lot you can do. You know, you can do quite heavy concentric, eccentric, or go heavy isometric for the shorter repeated holds, or you can go like your supra maximal eccentric. But again, you need your leg press or Smith machine for that. But if someone comes in with a low baseline, you know, we just do some basic stuff, maybe like sets of 8 to 12, 4 sets of 8 to 12 reps, you know, with a 2 rep in reserve sort of loading guide, you know, just work the calf to fatigue. They're going to get better without any for a start, and then it's where do you go next? And that should develop calf capacity. Sometimes, you know, and again, you might just pick up this visually, they might be lacking, they might have some atrophy to either their medial or lateral gastroc on one side or both sides, or there might be, it could be an atrophy to medial gastroc on one side and their lateral on the other side. We've had a few cases of that. So you can manipulate foot position to try and bias those particular muscle heads, and work it to fatigue and into length to try and get those hypertrophy changes and I suppose balance out the strength a bit more across all three. They will be the main exercise types. Again, if we have to target the soleus, we do some isolated stuff with an event. So either very, very heavy kettlebell or else Smith machine, or ideally if you've got a seated calf machine, you can go really heavy and be quite stable. And again, with the soleus, given the physiology of the muscle, you know, you can still make good strength changes, even working to endurance off moderate load. So you can still, if you just make the muscle tired, it's going to get stronger anyway, to a point. And then it's like, you might get to a point then where you hit a ceiling where you may need to go really, really heavy for low volume to increase the force capacity even further. But it just depends.
Go on.
No, you're okay. No, I'm just saying you use your tests, your straight leg and your bent knee, your seated calf test to, you know, if your seated calf test is quite good in proportion to your straight leg one, well, then we might need to worry too much about the soleus, unless maybe in field sports where acceleration is quite important and you are going to use the soleus a little bit more in isolation, particularly in the early to mid stance of an acceleration or a jump or a horizontal, some sort of a horizontal effort. I think it's useful to do that and train it, as I mentioned in the article, in synergies with the foot and with hip extension. But say for a distance runner, you know, if the soleus is quite good and you test it, and there's maybe room to improve their overall calf strength, well, then we just go straight leg and keep it simple. Because again, time and energy resources are going to be valuable to, well, most athletes, but particularly endurance athletes, when you're always going to be tired anyway, no matter when you try to do an S&C or rehab session.
We'll get onto the foot in a second, but just one last thing. Would you be looking for a particular ratio between the isolated soleus and the general calf complex test?
Yeah, it's hard too, because in our clinic we're comparing a seated calf isometric with a straight leg isokinetic test. So yes. In fact, I suppose through coincidence, the numbers are actually similar. We look for a distance runner, maybe at least, I would even say now, like then we've tested a lot more and we're more robust with our protocols. We're getting higher numbers now because they're more stable in those positions. So we've seen more people hit twice body weight, and more people and maybe more sprint or explosive athletes getting, you know, 2.2 times body weight. So in the article, I would have said back then 1.6 and maybe twice body weight for distance runners and maybe sprint athletes respectively. But now we'd be kind of thinking maybe 1.8 and ideally twice body weight for a distance runner who wants to compete at a decent level, and maybe 2.2 and above for your sprinter athlete or field sport player. So yeah, it's hard to say there's a proportion when you're comparing an isometric with an isokinetic test. But again, for the isokinetic test, straight leg, we're looking at 160% body weight for your distance athletes, and maybe close to 200% body weight for our explosive athletes. And then we're also able to run a code to look at torque at different ranges. So someone might have good peak torque, but they may have big asymmetries in either slightly plantarflexed angles or slightly dorsiflexed angles, and we can focus on I suppose joint angle specific strength changes based on that.
I don't want to bring it down to my level, but I'm sure there's people out there. Just explain that a little bit more for us, the peak torque.
Yeah. So so basically, like it's like the turning force you're producing. So it takes into account the ankle the moment arm. So as well as the force you're producing. So we scale peak torque to body weight. So we divide the torque in newton meters by your body weight. So And again, we're seeing good numbers in the sort of high hundreds, so 150 to 200% body weight across the board. And we just kind of break it down a little more to sprint athletes and maybe field sport players versus your distance runners. Again, we do see a bit of a hybrid of you know, we see some people you'd expect big numbers from coming in at maybe 120% body weight, and maybe skinny distance runners coming in at close to 200% body weight. So there's a little bit of a hybrid with that as well. But anyway, so we measure peak torque, which usually happens in slight length. So it usually happens somewhere between 0 degrees or neutral ankle, maybe between that and maybe 10 degrees dorsiflexion. Obviously, you need a bit of length to produce your peak force or peak torque. And then we measure torque at 20 degrees plantar flexion and 10 degrees dorsiflexion. So particularly for someone who's had an Achilles rupture, where they're going to be weak in inner range plantar flexion, we see big deficits there, and it takes a long time to address and reverse. And I suppose you probably only get so far with that. Other cases, you might see someone who's quite weak in more dorsiflex angles. So 10 degrees dorsiflexion, there might have maybe a 20% difference, even though the peak torque might look symmetrical. So we can use that those findings to get someone, if it's an inner range plantar flexion deficit, do some inner range isometric work, and load them there to try and strengthen in that area. Or if it's a dorsiflexion, a dorsiflex angle deficit, you know, work them into length, into a sort of an eccentric loading scheme, or else do some long length isometric holds to get them stronger at that angle. I hope that makes sense.
You know, yeah, I'm following. I'm following. No, thanks, mate. Appreciate that. So you mentioned foot strength. I think this is a really interesting area. How are we assessing whether we need to isolate or have that isolated type of training in our program? Or should it be across the board, even without any assessment?
I mean, it is quite important, and it's not something that has been done traditionally outside of, say, a clinic environment. So it's not something that's I suppose, typically done in an SNC program. Obviously, I see a lot of feet. I've had a lot of good practitioners that I network with and who specialize in foot area that I bounce ideas off. And, you know, so when we kind of talk back and forth, I suppose good ideas can emerge from that. So, so what I've done is developed a test with a handheld dynamometer, where if you test them in with a slight dorsiflexed ankle angle and dorsiflexion of the first MTP joint, so the big toe joints, you just literally lift the big toe up. So they're at a long length, you're getting a measure of their flexor lucis longus, which is quite one of the important extrinsic foot muscles that has a role to play in terms of a toe off. And then we would do the same thing with more of a plantar flex angle to get a measure of the intrinsic foot muscles. So we're making the flexor lucis longus short and a little bit insufficient. So we're getting more isolated measure of the intrinsic foot muscles, which are actually quite important. And they have a big role to play in coordination of the foot, to stiffen the foot at the right time, for propulsion of toe off, you know, so particularly for acceleration, for jumping, you know, the muscles across the big toe have quite a significant, small but significant contribution to those type of to performance, you know, in sprint and jumping and push off positions. So there's three key muscles that cross the big toe joint: your flexor hallucis brevis, your adductor, and abductor hallucis, which are, you know, as foot muscles go, they're quite big volume and a big physiological cross-section area. So when we measure toe flexor strength, we're getting a measure of the force output of those muscles in particular.
So we're just going to take a quick break in this chat with Colin. Hope you enjoyed part one. So hope in part two, we discuss developing reactive strength during the return to play process and developing explosive strength during the return to play process. How can we assess if those areas need to be improved, and how can we obviously go about doing that? So really interesting part two coming up. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Kitman Labs. Kitman Labs is sport's first technology company to offer a complete solution that includes innovative analytics and an advanced athlete management platform that is supported by a team of sports, technology, and data science experts with over 200 years' experience. Kitman Labs is leading the evolution of sports performance, partnering with over 150 elite teams across the NFL, NHL, MLB, AFL, EPL, and Championship Rugby. Through advanced statistical analysis, rigorous scientific research, and unparalleled industry experience, they've architected the world's only analytics platform that helps sports teams to truly harness their data and uncover the influences behind performance optimization and injury risk. To find out more about Kitman Labs, visit kitmanlabs.com or follow them on social media at Kitman Labs. And also sponsoring this episode is Samson Equipment. Samson Equipment has been manufacturing elite strength equipment since 1976. Based in New Mexico, Samson provides professional weight room solutions for those looking to lead the way in advancing our strength and conditioning profession. Being a direct manufacturer, the team at Samson brings fully customization capabilities in not only branding, but in custom equipment needed to execute your programming. The Samson team brings many years of experience not only in coaching, but in manufacturing high quality strength equipment. So there is no vision too great. If you can dream it, they can build it. Find them on social media at Samson_EQ. And for more information, visit their website, samsonequipment.com, or email andy@samsonequipment.com. And now back to the episode with Colin. It is something that you see pop up every now and again on social media, and it normally gets a lot of hype because it's relatively novel. You don't see it a lot. But should people, given the time pressures of people like yourself, or pre-2013, Colin, with training team sport athletes who are getting a minimum time in the gym to develop all these different things, but should practitioners be focusing on this particular area more than they are?
Yes, at least, you know, screen version, if someone is weak in that area and they have a history of lower limb injuries, you know, I think it's an obvious low-hanging fruit to try and address. You know, if you've had a history of recurrent foot or ankle injuries or even calf injuries, I think it's quite an important area to look at. Doesn't take that long to assess. You can even, you know, if you have enough experience, clinical experience behind you, or even just practical experience, you can get a manual feel of the total flexor strength. A lot of the time, it's just muscle inhibition. Those muscles are quite prone to inhibition for different reasons. Oftentimes I just build in some foot exercises, more of an activation into the warm up. So you've got better contribution of those muscles in those bigger sort of compound movements. Sometimes you might use neuromuscular re-stimulation to try and increase the activation of those muscles. I think it's just been an overlooked area, and I suppose it's starting to, with the help of some good research that's come out of a couple of labs across the world, particularly in Queensland, Australia. Luke Kelly and his team have done a lot of good work on foot research, and I suppose traditionally, we would have always thought that what they call the windlass mechanism. So when you dorsiflex the big toe, that stiffens the arch and stiffens the foot. So it's more of a, it passively stiffens it. But the emerging research from the group I mentioned, the activation of the foot muscles are probably more important, are probably the big players in terms of stiffening the foot at the right time, particularly in toe off. And the windlass mechanism is certainly plays a role, but it's not the deal breaker. So definitely important that we have good foot strength and be able to activate it at the right time during the gait cycle, particularly as we go to toe off.
I think JB Mamrin's got a PhD student or a couple of PhD students in this area as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Roman Turlan, yeah, we actually chat regularly, so watch out for him. He'll have some really good work in the next couple of years when he gets towards the latter stage of his PhD.
I'm pestering the life out of him for an article on this area. I think he's gonna pull it together in a couple of months. So we're really looking forward to that. I think it's a super interesting area. So we've gone through that assessment. How are we training it?
I have a simple go-to, like just doing some band-resisted big toe curls. Just getting the foot set up with the big toe joint on the block and the rest of the toe hanging off it. And maybe bringing it into a little bit of plantar flexion. So you're taking out the contribution from the tibialis anterior, or your anterior shin muscle. And you can, you know, start off with the foot flat, with the knee sort of sitting behind the ankle to be slightly plantar flexed. And then you can actually just do an active heel raise to really activate or maximize the activation of those foot intrinsic muscles. And you want to feel like a burning or a cramping sensation in the arch. So we do that more so as an activation exercise. But like when you're doing single leg calf raises, particularly with shoes off, ideally. You know, at that sort of top position, if you're doing a little short isometric hold at the top, you know, you're getting good recruitment of the foot muscles anyway, and also tib post and your peroneals. So you're getting everything in that one lift. So if someone is limited in that particular movement or that particular position, we just work back from that. What's the limiting factor? Is it the lack of foot strength or recruitment that's not allowing them to be stable there? And if it is, we bring in those isolated exercises to support them to get to that point. But look, you want to get to the point where an athlete can get a lot out of as few exercises as possible, you know, especially in the busy part of the season. So last thing someone wants to do is spend an hour and a half or 2 hours, you know, doing a whole load of rehab exercises when there's other demands on their time and their energy resources.
Of course. So for someone that's quite well versed in this area and speaking to a lot of people in terms of the groups that we've mentioned, JB and the Queensland, did you say?
Yeah.
What do you think is coming down the line for this particular area in terms of research?
I think what's come out in the last few years, I mean, there's been several papers, you know, since 2014 from Luke Kelly's group that have really, I suppose, changed people's thinking around this area. So, you know, I think there's a lot already done. I suppose it's just maybe being a bit cleaner or tidier with some of our ways of assessing foot strength and maybe coming up with some sort of a solution with a force plate or a strain gauge where you can do it properly. You know, handheld dynamometer, if I'm doing it myself all the time, I'm probably confident in my own reliability. But if someone else was to do what I was doing, it mightn't be very reliable. So. That's why it can be hard to compare numbers. So maybe having some sort of a cleaner solution might be better. And then I suppose just being a bit more creative with some of our exercises to target certain muscles in the foot. You know, I still feel like I have a lot more need to learn about the area. I'm only scratching the surface.
In the article, just moving on from the foot stuff, and although I think that's super, super interesting and looking forward to getting a piece on Sportsmith about it. But back to the rehab, developing reactive strength during the return to play process. Interesting, probably second half of the article that you wrote, focusing on this area and then developing explosive strength again during that return to play process. So the reactive strength first, moving through a rehab, how can we understand how much emphasis we need to put on this particular phase during a particular rehab? So we can spend the time or tick the box and kind of move on. Is there any, again, moving back to the assessments, is there any assessments that you would do to help you guide whether you need to spend that time on this particular area in terms of reactive strength?
Yeah, well, look, I think every athlete probably needs to spend time on this, and it probably should be the mainstay of any sport that involves running or some bit of impact or reactivity. It should be nearly a mainstay of the program. But in rehab, I think it's a key link between your gym-based rehab stuff and your return to sport, whether it's on the field or on the track or on the road. Exposing the muscle tendon unit to those high, I suppose, loading rate demands. You know, the fast stretch that the Achilles tendon has to accommodate, the ability to coordinate around the ankle and the knee and the hip quite quickly, even pre-activate before contact. So yeah, it's quite important. You know, we talk a lot about rate of force development and early versus late phase rate of force development, and more sports where there's reaction involved, you know, your early phase, which is like how much, you know, the biggest change in force in those first 50 to 100 milliseconds, it's quite important. And, you know, your ability to pre-activate, it's what you do before you hit the ground is actually quite important. So you're relying a lot on pre-activation of the lower leg muscles and the elastic properties of the Achilles tendon in particular. So reactive strength is closely linked to that. It is quite important, and I suppose just how you go about programming, because you know you take different clusters of athletes and they're all going to have different reactive strength profiles. Some are more, you know, like to use more ground and maybe spend a bit longer on it to get their impulse to get good jump height, whereas others are quick and springy and maybe you might need to try and get a bit higher with that same sort of you know, short contact time. And then you got, I suppose, the bits in between, you know. And then I suppose you work the spectrum of you know, short contacts versus maybe slightly longer contacts, getting more impulse and maybe working the contractile properties of the muscles a little bit more. And then maybe, you know, so I suppose, as I mentioned in the article, and again, purely from experience and I suppose other people who have done a lot of pioneering work in this area and some of them whom you've had on your podcast, you know, starting off with just some basic coordination patterns, you know, and I have pushed a few exercises from different people, as you do, but like just doing basic pogo hops. I really like the rudiment series that Altus and have used, and Boo Schneider, I really like that as a way just to try and get some basic coordination patterns going, particularly people who are not as experienced with plyometrics, just getting their alignment between ankle, knee, and hip and shoulders, minimizing the knee bend and contact, trying to get the active dorsiflexion when they come off the ground, and progressing onto single leg and trying to keep those qualities going. And then when you've got a bit of a background behind you, then it's you know, where do you go then next? You know, do you intensify it or do you add more challenges or more complexity to it, or go for a bit more volume or capacity work? You know, and yes, yeah, so like you would go into your drop jumps, hurdle hops, and then particularly for calf and Achilles injuries or ankle injuries in general, I like to bring in like incline hopping, where it's up steps in a stadium, or it's up a hill or an incline, where you really kind of have to coordinate around the ankle better, and you're really sort of working on the contractile machinery of your calf muscles as well. So and particularly come back from those calf injuries, I think an exposure to that is quite useful, as opposed to minimize the risk of them breaking down again when they get back running at those sort of moderate to high volumes again.
What kind of athlete were you, Colin? Were you in the spend a little bit more time on the ground to get the height, or were you more reactive? I was neither, so it's all good.
Well, I was a race walker, so I never left the ground. I'm only figuring it out now in the last 10 years. But as a transition runner now, like I've been running for the last, since I retired from race walking, I've been running now, and particularly over longer distances. And so actually, very funny story. I went to sidetrack too much. I was over in Monaco for a conference back in 2017, as the IOC conference, and I was actually staying in Nice. And I just began working with JB Morin, he's my PhD supervisor. So I was staying in the south run along the promenade one morning, heard someone just come up behind me in the car, you know, give me a beep, and I looked around, it was JB. And he was actually driving to Monaco to the conference. And then we met afterwards. He goes, yeah, do you know, I spotted you because you run like a race walker.
Obviously not a good thing in his eyes.
Yeah, but that was here it is. But I've probably got a little bit bouncer since then. But yeah. But,
I didn't realize he was. Well, I remember he did actually. But now I think about it, he was your PhD supervisor.
He is, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because I'm registered to University of Côte d'Azur, which is like a doctor school that takes in University of Nice and Marseille. So JB's my supervisor, although he's left. He moved back to University of Saint-Étienne since then, but that doesn't change. Doesn't change things for me. But yeah.
How many times have you been out there?
Maybe once or twice a year pre-pandemic, whereas now I suppose I'm able to manage things remotely. All my work is done in Dublin, all my data collection is done in the clinic, so everything else then can be done through Zoom or whatever. So hopefully the next time I'm back there will be for my PhD defence, in hopefully before the end of the year.
It's beautiful out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lovely part of the country. It's really nice, especially in the summer.
Yeah, absolutely. So explosive strength. Moving on from reactive strength to explosive strength, again, something you mentioned later on in the article. Assessments during the return to play process, how much time we need to spend on this, or we're just ticking the box? What assessments would you run your athletes through to guide this next part of the return to play process?
Yeah, I think even a simple thing like hopper distance, because we know from some of the papers that came out of a group in Aspitar back in the last 2 years, and it was more focused on the usefulness or lack of for using a single leg hopper distance in ACL rehab, particularly during the propulsive phase, because there's probably a lot less knee contribution during the propulsive phase, a lot more maybe during the landing phase where the knee is more of an absorber. But from that, when they looked at the joint work contribution, there was I suppose the ankle and the hip contribute the most to the propulsive phase of a horizontal hop. And when you look at the muscle forces that they measure, the soleus is by far the biggest force contributor. So I think if you're doing a single leg hopper distance test, you're getting a good measure of explosive qualities from the soleus muscle, and in particular, especially when you're going from a bent knee position, because you have an accelerated center mass, which the soleus has a big role in that. So that's probably one way, the simplest way to do it as an assessment. As part of my PhD work, I've tested the reliability and looked at some of the biomechanical features of a single leg horizontal rebound. So it's like a double single leg hop. So we hop on the force plate and rebound for distance. And we looked at a lot of variables, and we actually looked for, trying to propose, which some have kind of touched on before. I'm not saying we pioneer this, but just trying to maybe strengthen the case for using a horizontal reactive strength index as a horizontal alternative to a vertical reactive strength index, so measuring rebound, dividing rebound distance by the contact time. So we looked at that. We looked at leg, vertical, and joint stiffness. And we looked at hip, knee, and ankle joint power and joint work, and the joint angle changes. And similar to the hop for distance paper in Aspetar, the ankle, you know, had the ankle and sort of slightly lesser degree the hip had the biggest contribution to joint work and power. And then the knee obviously had a lower contribution, but it had the highest. It was the one joint that had the higher stiffness than say the ankle or the hips. So yeah, any sort of horizontal jump will give you a good measure of lower limb explosive strength qualities. And you will get it from vertical too, like so something like a squat jump or a current movement jump. You're probably getting a good measure of explosive qualities as well from the lower limb, and particularly the calf. So. Yeah, I think either or, and then there might be some logic between using maybe one vertical or maybe one horizontal one, depending on the sport you're working with.
Just the horizontal RSI, so hopping onto the force plate, and mm-hmm. then going for distance on the rebound. Okay.
Yeah, and trying to minimize
using that as the ratio. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Has that got any? I know you said you're not. There's been other work before you in this area, but is that got more performance-related information that could be taken on further by yourself or others?
Look, it's purely exploratory. I think it's something for something for someone to take up and maybe investigate further. We don't have anything to correlate with those type of outcomes with performance, but again, if you're a jump athlete, you know, if you're a long jumper, triple jumper, I think for acceleration. I think there might be some potential there to think those qualities and use it as a measure of it.
So return to play process, done the assessment, explosive strength, the aim, where we're going with it to build this athlete back up to then back into training.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, as soon as they can run, do some basic linear running, we bring it in. Even if they're only at basic sort of plyometric level. But we want to make sure that the house is in order, you know, so that they're quite proficient at the plyometric. They can handle a good amount of plyometric volume, single leg, multi-directional if we need to, if it's a field sport player, before we start to bring in some, you know, a phase of volume running. Because it's the return to run phase, particularly for calf injuries, where things can flare up again, you know, and there's always that risk of a calf injury, because you're dealing even with a muscle injury, it's primarily tendon tissue that's involved, and tendon tissue takes a lot longer to remodel, so it's a bit of a long game, and you always have to. It's easy to if you're just purely use symptoms as a guide, you could be pain free, you could be functionally well, but there's ongoing remodeling going on there in the background that you don't see, and that could be up to 6 months based on one study using who retrospectively did MRI follow-ups in muscle injuries, so that's gone for several months. So if you have cut corners to get back playing or performing, and you've kind of backed off a little bit in your rehab, thinking you're out of the woods, you know, you're still at a very, very high risk of a reoccurrence. So I think it's really important that we expose them to a good level of reactive strength work and a level of volume running. So maybe it depends on the sport, obviously, but distance runners are going to build up their volume anyway. But for field sports, you know, maybe having exposure to a moderate amount of volume at a moderate to high intensity, for a phase before we can be, I suppose, comfortable returning them back to their competition.
How important is it to be super careful post calf injury in that introduction back to running? Unlike something like a hamstring, where you get into high speeds to get into that danger zone.
Yeah,
calf, yeah. You're in it straight away.
It's almost like the reverse. So like obviously with a hamstring, you can probably get away with like low intensity, moderate intensity running. I mean, again, without deviating too much, I had a hamstring injury before a marathon back 3 years ago, 4 weeks out. And it was a grade 2B, so it was a myotendinous junction, bicep femoris. And I was quite aggressive with my rehab, and because I was rehabbing myself and I was, I suppose, willing to take risks. And if I didn't make the marathon, you know, it was no big deal. It's a bonus if I could. But I managed to get it resolved, managed to run a PB that day. But I know if I was a sprinter, I wouldn't have got away with it, because I wouldn't have just been able to handle maximum speed running, but obviously didn't have to in those final few weeks before a marathon. So yeah, but for the calf injury, particularly soleus, you can probably kind of go short to long, which are progression. Maybe bring in some like short, not I wouldn't say sprints, but like maybe working 80 to 90% of their maximum velocity over, you know, 50, 60 meter repeats. They could probably handle that. And while you're trying to build capacity concurrently, and then you can, I suppose, start to increase their volume, you know, gradually over a week or two. So you can kind of go short to long with those calf injuries, whereas in hamstrings, you probably have to go sort of, you know, gradually slow to fast, you know, and making sure everything's in order before we bring in high speed running.
Cool. And your PhD in the end of Achilles rehab?
Achilles rehab, yeah, and lower limb biomechanics. Yeah. So, yeah.
So is there any... coming towards the end?
Coming towards the end, yeah. So I've one study to finish off, and I'm writing my thesis at the moment. So hoping to have it submitted in the next over the winter months, and hopefully have my defence before the end of the year. So yeah, it's been a 5-year journey. So yeah, the broad topic being Achilles rehab and lower limb biomechanics. So we have a couple of chapters in it. So two papers. Well, one paper would be the horizontal rebound test that I mentioned, testing the reliability and looking at the biomechanical features of that, which we have a paper in submission at the moment. And then another reliability paper for seated calf isometric test that we're just about to finish and get ready for submission. And then our main study would be a RCT on runners, participants who take part in sports that involve running. So it's not just distance running, it's field sports. So any sport that involves running, who have chronic mid-portion Achilles tendinopathy, so having symptoms more than 3 months, pain in the mid portion of the tendon as opposed to the around the heel insertion. So we randomize them into one of two groups. So one group follows a program that we put together that's based on 2 or 3 high intensity sessions a week. Multifactorial, so working on calf strength, plyometrics, guiding the running, and then another group follows a program that's kind of it's a Silbernagel protocol. So Karen Silbernagel is a prominent tendon researcher based in the University of Delaware, and her protocol it's kind of similar nature in that it has multi exercise types. So you know, combined concentric, eccentric, and so on, bringing in plyometrics, but probably a little bit less specific in terms of how you progress it. So it's more based on symptoms, whereas we're kind of hit certain strength targets to guide progression. To a maximum level of tolerable pain as opposed to just relying on pain to progress. And we test them at the start and then at week 6 and week 12, and then we do long-term questionnaire follow-ups. So we look at the running mechanics and using 3D motion capture, we test their calf strength isokinetically, straight leg and bent knee, and then we look at their vertical drop jump and single leg horizontal rebound. So that's been our big study. And then I've also got a single case report that I'm preparing to submit on a football player in Ireland who sustained an Achilles rupture last springtime when inter-county training resumed after the restrictions. So it was the first week back, and he had a surgical repair. So we were able to collect some useful data on him over his nine-month rehabilitation journey, and also map out his rehabilitation. So there's 4 papers in that study, in my thesis, and that hopefully will be useful.
One last question. Biggest mistakes either you have made or others make when rehabbing an Achilles?
Whew, yeah.
I've put you on the spot there. Sorry, mate.
You have. No, we all make mistakes. I've made 20 mistakes. I'm just trying to Yeah, I think it's actually quite important because, you know, so with tendons, it's not just the tissue. It's not just the structural damage, and what you see in an MRI scan doesn't always match up to the pain response and all that. You know, there's a lot of other factors going on that we can't see, and it's very hard to quantify. Even the pain response that you get from Achilles tendon, a lot of that is just chemical noise in the tendon. So you've got the cells that react. You've got an inflammatory process that's not a normal part of exercise. We get an inflammatory response, and normally it resolves itself. And when the inflammatory response kicks off, the cells in the tendon, the tenocytes, become active, and you've got that sort of battle between release of production of enzymes that break down tendon tissue, and then the production of enzymes that help to repair it. And then you've got your inflammatory mediators, and then your inflammation resolving mediators. And oftentimes what you have then, when the tendon becomes more chronic, you've got an extra growth of blood vessels. And normally the tendon itself, the actual collagen fibers, don't have much blood supply, direct blood supply or nerve supply. Normally the nerve and blood supply is on the periphery in that sort of synovial space. But when you've got a chronic tendinopathy, that you get an extra ingrowth of blood vessels towards the core of the tendon. And then with that, you've got a sprouting of the nerve endings. And those nerve endings are quite exposed. They're unmyelinated, so they're quite exposed to noise in the area. And they just become sensitized to those sort of that chemical noise. And that's what kind of drives the pain. So that's a tricky one. And then you've got people, there's a nice paper there by, again, it was Sean Hanlon last year. He's part of Karen Silver-Nagel's group in Delaware, where he categorized three different subgroups of patients with Achilles tendinopathy. Those were more structure dominant. So that it's pretty much like a mismatch between load and capacity. And those who are more biopsychosocial dominant. So again, there's a lot of fears and catastrophizing beliefs around the symptoms. And that can increase, the sensitivity of the tissue and those nerve endings. And then maybe those who are more metabolic, which are probably the less sporty people, because the tendon can be sensitive to other things going on in the body. So I suppose, to get back to my main point, one thing I've probably learned over the years is to try and understand what the patient thinks or the athlete thinks is going on, what their understanding of it is, their process is. Because a lot of them will fear that they're going to rupture. And sometimes, yes, when you rupture, there probably is some pathology there that you mightn't see that might be make them a little bit more vulnerable. But when you are sore, you're probably not going to do things that are going to cause you to rupture, like doing something fast and explosive. So that pain can be a little bit protective. So trying to break down that barrier. But yeah, just definitely trying to involve the patient a lot more. And I suppose that's one thing I probably learned over the years, try to understand what way they're thinking. And if it's irrational, try in a very careful and sensitive way, try to break that down and work through it.
Love it. Sorry to put you on the spot there, but dealt with like a true professional. But no, thank you for coming on, Colin. Well, if anyone wants to keep up to date with what you've got going on, PhD-wise, other stuff going on, running, etc., where's the best place? Twitter, Instagram?
Both, yeah. I suppose I use Twitter a lot more for professional stuff. Just find a good resource. So yeah, a lot of good resources there. I like to try and, I suppose, share ideas. And it's always it's a good tool too when you're limited with characters in space, to try and get your own thoughts together concisely, and so try to use it for that purpose and share and I suppose learn from others and try and stay out of things I don't need to get involved in. So in Twitter, yeah, my handle is at Colin Griffin. I got in there good and early when I was able to get my
you
own
did.
Name but have to add other characters to it
with the blue tick as well.
Yeah, that was from the Olympics, but we all got that as a bonus back in London 2012.
Was that just a thing that went, if you were in the Olympics, you got a blue tick in 2012?
Yeah, right. That time, yeah. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I'll take it. so Twitter or LinkedIn as well, I often use that more, I suppose, more for professional stuff. But it works both ways. A lot of people have been very generous with their time to me over the years, and I've learned a lot from them. And if someone comes to me with a question, I'm always trying to help them. And if I can't help them, try and point them in the right direction. So always happy for people to reach out.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the last hour. Really appreciate your time. It's good to put a face to a name and face to an email address and all that kind of stuff. So look forward to keeping in touch and we'll chat soon.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Rob. Thanks very much for having me on. It's been good to chat.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for tuning in to episode 416 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. Big thanks to Colin for giving up his time in a very busy schedule with kids, family, work and studies going along at the same time. Big thanks to Hawking Dynamics, IMageU, Kitman Labs, Samsung Equipment and Play for sponsoring this episode today. The podcast could not run in its current form without these guys, so I really do appreciate all their support. Big thanks to you for tuning in and look forward to chatting to you next time. We'll